What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss. As Israel continues into its now more than 9-month violent onslaught on Gaza, some of the Palestinians who've been displaced from their homes are seeking refuge elsewhere. But leaving Gaza is no simple or cheap task. And fundraising is particularly hard when your access to electricity, internet, and ultimately community is not so reliable. Our guest today previously worked as a journalist in Ramallah in the West Bank, reporting on life under occupation. Since her time there, she's visited Palestine regularly and is now working from within the U.S. to help a family in Gaza find their way out. Renee Lewis joins us this morning from Washington State. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning. It's good to be here. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. So, Renee, I want to start with you, and then we'll move on to the campaign a little bit later. But just to bring us into the mindset that you have supporting these families, can you tell listeners about how you got involved in reporting on Palestine? And this was, I know, many years ago. And then the types of connections that you've maintained there since.
I went to Palestine in 2008 to be a reporter, and that was right after college. So I went over to Ramallah and ended up staying for 2 years. I reported on life under occupation for the Palestine Monitor, and a nonviolent protest movement was happening at the time, which was really exciting to cover. There were nonviolent marches every Friday in villages affected by illegal Israeli settlements.
Right.
So I started reporting over there. I fell in love with Palestine, made lifelong friends. I basically had surrogate family over there. Mm. It's really hard to describe what it's like to be in Palestine. You really have to go there to understand the warmth and the generosity of Palestinians. I've traveled all over the world and never met people like on average just so kind. So it's been really hard, I mean, ever since then, to watch the Israeli attacks, but this one especially difficult because of just how brutal it is. And it's weird to talk about my feelings when there's people in Gaza who are now used to seeing body parts scattered, you know, in the streets. But I am extremely worried about my friends and everybody in Gaza and the West Bank at this point.
Well, and you described what it's like to be in Palestine with Palestinians and how warm and welcoming and strong those communities are. What has it been like for you to stay connected from far away? How has that changed since October in particular?
Yeah, so over the years, I stayed in touch with my friends there. You know, social media made that easier as that came along. And then I would talk to them for stories, for news articles, because I was still reporting afterwards. We would catch each other up on our lives. A lot of my friends are married with kids now. I got the chance to go back and visit a few times after leaving. So stayed very close friends with several of my friends there. And on October 7th, it was one of those moments for me that you just, like, I remember exactly where I was when I started seeing the news that day. It was just one of those moments that I won't forget because I had a very, very bad feeling, obviously, about what was going to happen in response in Gaza. I had seen and reported on earlier Israeli attacks on Gaza, and I knew that it was going to be bad. I just didn't expect the level of destruction that we've seen. It's a level of dehumanization that's not only coming from the Israelis, but the entire world, and that was surprising to me.
I know that since that time, you've been involved in a handful of, I guess I would call them mutual aid efforts or just support efforts for individual Palestinians trying to figure out their livelihoods. And in this more recent case that we'll talk about in just a moment, trying to figure out their livelihood outside of Palestine, figuring out a way to leave. What brought you to try to do this direct kind of mutual aid support?
Since October, I've been checking in with my friends, mostly to, you know, just let them know that I care and to ask if I can do anything to support them. It's been difficult for people in the West Bank to carry on with their lives as normal. Even though they're not being carpet bombed, life has become a lot more difficult there economically. People that work for the Palestinian Authority government haven't gotten regular salaries for 9 months. People who work, you know, in other cities sometimes can't travel between towns safely. So I've been checking in. Another effort that I was working on previously was trying to connect some of my friends with remote work, because sometimes they were not able to work in the West Bank and when they had to go in person. So since they have professional skills, I worked with a former colleague on this to try and connect them with remote work and got a couple people hooked up with some jobs.
Every little thing matters. So right now you're a part of an international effort to help 6 Gazan siblings evacuate from Palestine. Can you tell us about the family and how you got involved in this campaign in particular?
So I asked one of my friends how things were going and if there was anything I could do to help one day. And he came back and said that a person he knew from his gym, who was from Gaza, had told him about his family in Gaza and that their house had been bombed and that they were living in a tent. And my friend knew this guy from the gym before the war started, but after the war started, they became closer. So eventually, this man told my friend, and I'm intentionally not using names because it's not safe.
Right.
This is a safety issue in the West Bank. Anyways, the man told my friend that he wanted to set up a GoFundMe to help his 6 children, their mother and aunt, evacuate from Gaza because it's not safe anywhere in Gaza. They don't have a house. A few of the kids are injured from the bombing. A few of them have hepatitis from dirty water. So they need medical treatment and they need to be somewhere safe. The problem is, if you don't have a US or European bank account, you can't set up a GoFundMe. So since that's the biggest way to fundraise, I thought we should do it there. And I would help with using my bank account for now. And so since then, the first step was just creating the GoFundMe. And then we've tried to do updates. I've had interviews with the oldest brother in Gaza and the father in West Bank. I have reached out to my entire reporting network at this point, looking for any support in sharing this around or getting, you know, pitching my article about the family to different outlets like Al Jazeera. And in the process of this, was reaching out to a lot of former colleagues, and one of them, Ned, who's a former colleague from Al Jazeera English, he's back in Johannesburg, South Africa now. And when he heard about the campaign, he really jumped in and wanted to do anything he could to help, because he said, you know, for like many of us, watching the impact on children in Gaza has just been heartbreaking. And even though a lot of us feel powerless to do anything to help, in this case, we can help one family. So Ned has continued to be in the media world and is up to date more than I am with media and content creation and, you know, how to push a campaign like this forward. So he has really jumped in and helped me to strategize and figure out what we need to do to get this fundraiser moving again, because it is, it has a long ways to go.
So just to be clear really quickly, what's the goal of this fundraiser?
The goal of the fundraiser is to raise enough money for the six kids and their mom and aunt to evacuate Egypt to Egypt from Gaza.
And what are the financial implications of that? I mean, we can imagine some element of cost, but for those of us who are not involved in this exact work, it's like it can be hard to really ground ourselves in like what actually costs money versus what takes an emotional toll and takes this or that kind of work and paperwork. What does the money actually, what do you hope the money will go toward?
Right. So a little context just for the listeners. So unlike a normal war or conflict zone, people in Gaza can't just escape. They're trapped. The border crossings are controlled by Israel, except for one at Rafah that goes to Egypt. And that's pretty much indirectly controlled by Israel. So people in Gaza are literally wandering from north to south right now, trying to find a safe place to go. The only way out is through the border at Rafah into Egypt. There is an Egyptian quote-unquote travel agency that sprung to life right around the time of this war that charges $5,000 a person to evacuate people from Gaza into Egypt. So the money that we're hoping to raise is just to cover the costs to pay that travel agency called Hala in Egypt, the money to get the family out of Gaza into Egypt. Right now, the border has been destroyed by Israel, so it needs to be repaired and rebuilt, but that's still their goal. They want to be able to raise the money to pay the travel agency to get out of Gaza into Egypt using their passports. There's no UN involved. There's no refugee status. After that, they want to go back to Ramallah, where their father is. Their father had been in the West Bank, like I said, receiving medical treatment and was there when the war started, so they have been separated. The family would like to go to Ramallah to reunite with him. And then one day, when it's possible, you know, and safe to live a normal life, they would like to go back to Gaza, because it's a difficult decision to leave your home for anyone, but especially for Palestinians when they've been basically fighting for their existence by just staying on their land for so many decades since the Israeli occupation began. So it is a very difficult choice.
Right. And I don't know about this particular family, but like you mentioned, many of the Palestinians living in Gaza have been refugees since 1948. It sounds like this family is trying to go to Egypt only because it's the only way out, and then back to the West Bank.
Yes.
Not even to seek asylum or refugee status elsewhere. One of the things that was mentioned in the press release about this fundraiser is that there are concerns over validity of these kinds of fundraising campaigns that have challenged fundraising efforts in general, and maybe specifically here. Can you talk a little bit about what that means? What are we talking about with concerns of validity? What's challenging that? And on the other hand, how can you, I guess, I don't know if this is the right phrase for it, but guarantee validity to people who might be able to donate?
It's very difficult right now. The first thing that I'll put out there is that GoFundMe put up some extra barriers to me after we got the fundraiser up and going. They actually paused the fundraiser for a little bit while they asked me for more information to verify all the details. So I got things like pictures of the family's members' passports and things like that. So GoFundMe is suspicious of these things. Potential donors are suspicious of these. I think one of the biggest problems is that people are assuming that there's Hamas, you know, members who are putting these up somehow during a genocide and, you know, making money that way, which is ridiculous to me. Another problem is that a lot of people in Gaza may not speak English. Right now, they don't have a lot of internet or electricity. So if they put something up on GoFundMe somehow, it might not look that good. It might not, you know, to an American who doesn't understand why you can't make it look, you know, real, basically. Where are the pictures? Where's all the details? You know, things like that. So in this case, for the GoFundMe that I organized, the only difference really is that the father knew my friend who knew me, and I live in the U.S., so I could make the GoFundMe, and I had the time and, you know, electricity and laptop to make the fundraiser and make it look decent. I also have access to a large international network from my reporting career. So they were able to support me as well, or support the fundraiser. And that's really the only difference. I mean, I've received requests in my social media for other families' GoFundMes from Gaza. And even though I'm, you know, organizing one, I have the same thoughts as everybody else. Like, who are you? How do I know that you're real? So I guess I don't necessarily have a good answer, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things that you have in this context that some other folks don't have is, like, you've built years of trust and community with people, with Palestinians living in Palestine. And so because, like you mentioned earlier in our conversation, that GoFundMe requires you to have either, I believe you said, a U.S. or European bank account, that these campaigns, I can imagine, can look fishy for people.
Right.
Is that right, that it has to be U.S. or European bank accounts?
Yes.
Right. So you maybe partially answered this question already, but I'm wondering if, for the family that you're involved in fundraising for at this point, do you believe their family story in this moment is exceptional in any way among other Palestinians who are surviving in Gaza? I mean, there's certainly many other fundraising campaigns that are working on similar things. But once you're able to fulfill this fundraising effort, and when this family, we hope, is able to get out of Gaza and reunited with their family member in the West Bank, well, what do you do next as an outsider? Do you continue to try to create more of these fundraising campaigns?
So for the first part, I don't think that this family is necessarily exceptional, except, like I said, that they happen to know someone who knows someone who knows a whole lot of other people and all want to help.
Right.
After this fundraiser, I don't plan on continuing, you know, to make fundraisers for other families. One thing that Ned brought up when we originally started working on this together is, you know, making that kind of one of the points in an article that I pitch, as far as, you know, this is a barrier to people raising money to escape right now. So what do we do? I don't necessarily have the answer, but I would like to make that, to put it out there in a feature article and use my news writing skills to at least put the issue out there and see if somebody else maybe has a way to address that.
please let us know when you do that. We would love to feature that article as well. Renee, we are running out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I would just add that everybody in Gaza right now is dealing with having lost the idea of their future and all their hopes, just like Karam in this GoFundMe talking about his university being bombed and his dreams of starting his own computer engineering company dashed. So anything we can do individually or collectively to help get a ceasefire and end this war as soon as possible would be excellent.
Would absolutely be excellent. And there is a link to the fundraiser that Renee's been discussing on the archive of this show at kpfa.org. So if you're looking for that fundraising link, go to kpfa.org and find Law and Disorder episode from today, which is Monday, July 8th. That's our time this morning, Renee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's the voice of Renee Lewis, a reporter who previously worked in Ramallah in the West Bank, reporting on life under occupation. Since her time in Ramallah, she has visited Palestine regularly and is now working from the U.S. to help a family in Gaza find their way out. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law and Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.